In other words, does silent mean never say a word, period? If that's so, then there are things that she couldn't do that we understand women to be able to do. She couldn't sing, for example, because singing involves using the voice. She couldn't participate, as a matter of fact, in any audible way in the assembly. We can talk about that a little bit more maybe in the question and answer session too. I have some opinions about some other things, but I think singing is the best illustration of that. If it doesn't mean she can never say a word or utter a word, period, then what does it mean? And what I would suggest to you is that in this context, when Paul talks about a woman keeping silent in the church, and the word silent is the, I mean, it's the opposite, the textual opposite of the word speak. He's talking about what happens in this assembly. And as a matter of fact, women are not the only ones in this context who are told to keep silent in this assembly. Under certain circumstances, men are told to keep silent as well. Look at verse 28. I'll start with verse 27. If anyone speaks in a tongue, it should be by two or at the most three, and each in turn, and one must interpret. But if there is no interpreter, he must keep silent in the church. And then in verse 29, let the three prophets speak, and let the others pass judgment. But if a revelation is made to another who is seated, the first one must keep silent. And again, all I can do is just trust the judgment of others. My understanding is that phrase, keep silent, is exactly the same in verse 28 when it's talking about men, clearly, in verse 30 when it's talking about men, and then in verses 34 and 35 when it's talking about women. And so in this assembly, there are times when men have to keep silent. If another man is speaking, the men have to keep it. The other men have to be silent. The women have to be silent in this assembly of God's people at all times. So the restriction applies to both men and women, depending on the circumstances. But the context indicates that the circumstances in which these instructions are given is when the church is assembled together. Now that's 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 34 and 35. In a nutshell, I mean clearly in a nutshell, there are a number of other things undoubtedly that we could say. And there might very well be some deeper implications of the teaching here that I've not seen or that I'm missing. And if I'm missing something, I have no doubt that you will gently point it out to me a little bit later on. I'm a real simple person, and I'm not saying that in an apologetic way. It is what it is. And the teaching here has always seemed to me to be fairly simple, if you take it in context. That what God intended, and you look at the last verse, verse 40, of 1 Corinthians 14, all things must be done properly and in an orderly manner. How do we know what is proper? How do we know what is an orderly manner? The King tells us. God tells us what's proper and what's orderly. And what he says is, there's not to be confusion in the assembly. And so men are permitted to speak when this general assembly is convened. And I believe, by the way, that that's what the word ecclesia means. I've discarded in recent years, thanks to some of your help, some of the brethren who are here, some of your help, I've discarded lessons that I used to preach, defining ecclesia as the called out. That preaches, guys. I mean, it just really does. But the fact of the matter is, the word meant in the first century an assembly, a gathering of some kind or another. And that's the way it's used in the New Testament. And what we have to do is, every time that word is used, we have to see what kind of assembly, what's being considered in the context. But in this assembly, men have to yield the floor of other men if another man is speaking, because there will be confusion. And in this assembly, the women have no right to speak at all, other than exceptions that might be granted. And again, where would we get those exceptions? We'd have to get them from the King. We'd have to get them from God. And God does give exceptions. All are instructed to sing, for example, again, when this assembly is convened. A woman can sing, and when she does, she's not violating the teaching of 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 34 and 35. Now, let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2. And I'm not going to take, I don't have the time really, I'm not going to take the time to read verses 8 through 15. But we'll look at verses 11 and 12. Where the Apostle Paul says a woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. But I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. What's different about the teaching here and the teaching in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 is that in 1 Corinthians 14, clearly it is in the assembly, when the church is assembled. That's not as clear in 1 Timothy chapter 2. There's no reference or mention of the assembly at all, as a matter of fact. A woman must receive instruction with entire submissiveness, but I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. So that raises legitimate questions. Do these restrictions in 1 Timothy chapter 2 apply only to the activities of the local assembly? Oh, and by the way, when I ask questions like this, there's no intended implication that I know the answers to. I'm just asking the question. Do these restrictions apply only to activities of the local assembly? Or do they apply to a Christian woman's demeanor in general? In what sense is a woman not permitted to teach? In what sense is the word quiet, and it's translated silence in the King James Version, in what sense is that word being used in this passage? In my studies down through the years, I've run across a number of people who have tried to limit this context to the public worship. But it seems to me as though the context is broader than what takes place just in the public worship. That it doesn't just apply, this teaching doesn't just apply to the assemblies of the local church. There are instructions about modesty, for example, in verse 9. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments. Seems to me as though that instruction, that teaching, applies to the woman's demeanor at all times, not just when she assembles together in the local church. You have the teaching about childbearing, which is problematic, and admittedly it's a passage, a concept that I've wrestled with now through the years. But the woman will be preserved through the bearing of children if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. Again, that has nothing to do, per se, with the local assembly. Going back to verse 8, the men in this context are instructed to pray in every place. Again, it doesn't seem that Paul is concerned just with the assembly, just with the worship of the local church. And so I would suggest that this teaching is broader in some sense. I suspect that we will disagree some among ourselves about how broad the teaching of this is and what the applications are. Again, we can talk about that during the question and answer session. But broader than just the local assembly. But what I would say about this is that it's a Christian woman to quietly receive instruction, learn quietly, English Standard Version, or Silence, King James Version, with entire submissiveness. What I've discovered in my studies down through the years on this text, when I've been teaching this or talking about this with other people, is that, and just like in 1 Corinthians 14, we need to understand what the word church means. We need to understand what the word silent means, what the word speak means. How are they being used in this context? The same thing is true with the word quiet. Thayer suggests about this particular word, and I've just included in quotes the definition, and this comes from an online version of Thayer, so I don't have any page number, but quietness, a description of the life of one who stays at home doing his own work and does not officiously meddle with the affairs of others. You know, this word quiet, and again, it's rendered silence in the King James translation, but quiet in some of the other translations, like the New American Standard, it doesn't enjoin the total absence of speech. And it's not really talking about, according to Thayer, it's not talking about just speech at all. It's talking about a style of life or a manner of life. A quiet life, a peaceful demeanor in which one fulfills his, and notice that Thayer uses male pronouns in his definition. But it refers to those who live a life by assuming their proper role. So the question then becomes, what's the point of the teaching here? A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness, but I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. In Titus chapter 2, 2, I'm not going to turn over there, but in Titus chapter 2, women are commanded to teach. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, women are forbidden to teach. And what I would suggest to you is that there are different circumstances and different kinds of teaching that are under consideration in those two places. Paul's statement in 1 Timothy chapter 2 is qualified. It refers to a particular kind of teaching. I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. In other words, she can't do any kind of teaching which would put her in a position of exercise. And again, we might disagree about what does that mean? How does a woman exercise authority over a man? But whatever it means, that's what qualifies the prohibition against a woman teaching in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 12. Again, Thayer says that it means to act authoritatively. When we talk about exercising authority, to act authoritatively, to exercise authority, to govern one, or to exercise dominion over one. And Linsky points out that the word that's translated nor, and he's referencing the King James translation, I suspect, because most of the modern English translations just translate the word or. And I don't know how to pronounce that word, and I won't even try. But that word, Linsky says that word is explicative in force. And what I understand that to mean is that it is explanatory. In other words, there aren't two prohibitions here. Number one, I do not allow a woman to teach. And number two, I do not allow a woman to exercise authority over a man. But I do not allow a woman to teach in such a way that she would be exercising authority over a man. That's the way that I've understood it. And again, if I'm wrong about that, or if I'm misrepresenting something about how that should be translated, I would be happy to learn something different about it. But that's been my interpretation of this passage now through the years, that a woman cannot teach in such a way as to exercise authority over a man. So what you have in 1 Timothy 2 and verse 12 is you have a prohibition against a woman preaching, and that would certainly include the general assembly of the church. How could she preach, or how could she teach that gathering in such a way that she was not exercising authority over that? It would forbid her from teaching a class where men are present, or exercising dominion over a class. This is not intended at all, and please don't take it that way, to be a woman joke. But the fact of the matter is, probably many of us have been in classes where a woman basically taught the class from her seat. And am I wrong about that? Have some of the rest of you experienced that kind of thing? Exercised authority. She didn't have to be standing up in front of a group. She didn't have to be the designated teacher. Her name doesn't have to be on the door. But she could be exercising authority over a man. That is what is prohibited here. And again, we looked at verses 14 and 15 a few moments ago. This passage, it doesn't permit a woman from teaching at all. It doesn't permit a woman, for example, from doing what she's commanded to do in Titus chapter 2, teaching other women. It doesn't prohibit, I don't believe, it prohibits her from engaging in discussions where the Bible is being taught. And I would use Aquila and Priscilla, and there they explain the way of God more accurately to Apollos in Acts chapter 18 as an illustration of that. And it's not a cultural situation. This is not, as some commentators and as some of our brethren have suggested, this is not just Paul talking about, well, that's the way the Roman culture was in the first century, or the Greek culture, or that's just a cultural thing, and it doesn't have anything to do with time. I'm going to do something that I promised myself I wouldn't do. How much time do I have?
13-14 minutes.
I'm going to editorialize about something. I am gravely concerned about some of what I'm seeing from brethren and some of what I'm hearing. And I think I know where it's coming from. I think it's coming from sources like N.T. Wright and some others. But there's an idea floating around, and it's not just floating around in Bowling Green. Among the college students, it's on the surface. And that is that the New Testament cannot be understood, not even in a basic and fundamental way, unless we have an intimate knowledge of Roman culture in the first century and Greek culture in the first century and Jewish culture in the first century. And as a matter of fact, I have quotes, I have articles and I have snippets from sermons that I've been collecting over the last couple of years from brethren, from preachers, who would even say that it's only been in the last 75 years that we really have the ability to know and understand what the New Testament teaches. I deny that with every fiber of my being. Does understanding something about the background of a writing help? Absolutely it does. And have not all of us, as we've taught 1st and 2nd Timothy and Ephesians, when you teach Ephesians, do you talk about Paul being in prison in Rome? Don't you talk about the other letters that he wrote about the same time, the prison epistle? You know, don't you put the maps up of the city of Ephesus? Don't you put Leon's incredible pictures of the architectural description? You know, the Temple of Diana, one of the wonders, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And how many columns are left, Leon? Is it just one? And Leon's got, I think it's Leon, it may be Brother Jenkins. Leon's got a picture of that column sitting in a swamp with a pelican sitting up on top of it. That's all that's left of it. We do that. I mean, we do that in our teaching. But is it fair to say that unless you know in some intimate way how the Greek mind worked, and how did the Roman mind work, and how did the Jewish mind work, that you can't really understand what the New Testament teaches? And I've had discussions with young people and older people alike in Bowling Green who have said that basically our, and by our they mean the Church of Christ, our interpretation of most things is tainted by cultural bias. We read the Bible through 20th and 21st century lenses. And so we've really missed the teaching about instrumental music. And we've really missed the teaching about the role of women in the local church. I don't know if any of you have run across anything like that or not, but that concerns me and scares me. I believe the Bible was written so that the common person could read it and understand and know exactly what God wanted them to know to be in a right relationship with Him. The common people are the ones who heard Jesus laugh. There's the editorial. Jim didn't. He's not even paying me for that. That's just
insane. It's a free.
Now, again, in a nutshell, I think that's the teaching of 1 Timothy chapter 2. Not a detailed study. I appreciate so much what some of you guys, Doy's material on Bible authority has been so helpful to me in Bowling Green. We've decided, the elders at Eastside have decided, with the college kids, every third year, we're going to do a class on Bible authority. Which means that if a kid comes there and stays for 4 years, they're going to get the class twice, but that's okay. And we've been looking for a way to teach these principles to the Bible, you know, to the kids in this class. And Doy, your material resonates with these college kids, and it's been so helpful. Thank you for sharing that with all of us. I have used it. I've tried to attribute some of it to you, even in the class. And Jeff's ability to analyze a passage. And just those kinds of things have been so helpful to me. I've not done that. And so if there's some gaps that need to be filled in, then please let's do that after. But perversions of this biblical teaching arising among our brethren. There have been questions and controversies about the role of women in the worship of the local church that go back hundreds of years, centuries, as a matter of fact. I think, though, just based on my study and my reading, that these issues about women among us, among our brethren, that has really come to the forefront in the last 50 years especially. And I attribute that at least in part to postmodernism and how postmodernism has impacted and affected our thinking about things. I think it's still true that we lag behind the religious world in general. That like the house church movement, somebody mentioned a little early. The house church movement has been, I'm not comfortable calling it that either, Jeff, but the house church movement, it's been around in the denominational world for decades. I mean, it took our brethren until about 10, 15 years ago to kind of latch on to that idea. We usually lag behind. And I think that's happened in this controversy about the role of women. And I would suggest to you that in my lifetime, I have encountered two extreme positions. The position that I would say, this is the left. Timmons, this is the left. These are the ultra-liberal Democrats. This is the progressive position, and that is that women can do anything in the local church that a man can do. I'm not talking about the denominational world. I'm talking about among our brethren. There is a segment among our brethren who contends that women can do anything, they can be anything in the assembly of the local church that a man can be or that a man can do. I've named some names. I hope I haven't misrepresented anybody here. I actually removed some names from the list that I originally had because I want to be fair. I want to be certain that I'm not misrepresenting someone. But Jay, and I don't know how to pronounce this last name. I've heard it two different ways. Jay Gwynn, and I've also heard it pronounced Jay Gwynn, even though it's not spelled the way that you spell it, right? But my understanding is that he's an attorney in Tuscaloosa, that he is a member of the university, I think it's called the University Church of Christ in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He's done extensive life on this non-traditional movement and has written a lot about the role of women. You have Bobby Valentine, Keith Brewitt, Carol Osborne, who is, I think, a faculty member at Abilene Christian University. He's also written extensively. A lot of what they've written is online. You can access almost all of Gwynn's material on his webpage or other places, and you can download a number of books that he's written in PDF format. I have downloaded several of his books. Bobby Valentine is the same way. Carol Osborne has digitized some of his writings. And they're free. I mean, you're not buying books for the sake of trying to figure out what brethren are teaching. You can download it for free. A couple of quotes from Gwynn. The Bible says that in God's eyes, there is neither male nor female. It means what it says. Boy, have we heard that someplace in this last couple of days? It means what it says. Passages that apparently limit women's role are written for a temporary cultural situation that no longer exists, much like the command of the Holy Kiss. From Valentine, I believe that, and the places where these things are found are listed in the bibliography, I believe that most uses of 1 Timothy 2 are illegitimate wresting of Scripture. Failures in both exegesis and hermeneutical approach mar typical use of the text. It is not a trump card against female participation in the assembly of the church. It is clear that Paul does not want women or men to domineer other Christians. Kevin provided you with a couple of quotations from Mike Root in his outline last night. I didn't repeat those, but you can find those on pages 30 and 31 of Kevin's. I think I referenced that correctly. The quotations from Mike Root along the same line. That's the left. I've also encountered and dealt with pretty extensively in my preaching life the extreme right. This would be the Tea Party. Brethren who insist that a woman can't do anything in the church assemblies, and would even take it a step beyond that to teach that women cannot teach Bible classes. Not even classes composed of women or children. I document some of that. I found out this just this past week. J.W. Hogan is still alive. I thought he was ancient when I went to this debate in 1979. But his son is carrying on his work and teaching, my understanding. And so in eastern Kentucky, southwestern Ohio, some places in southern Indiana, some places in south central Kentucky, you can still find this idea that women can't teach anything. That they can't even teach women, other women or children. I would suggest to you that the reason we're gathered here doesn't involve either one of us. It involves something more than that. And I've laid out two positions in the outline. Number one is where I stand. Women are prohibited from speaking when the local church is assembled for worship. And she may not at any time teach in such a way as to exercise authority over a man. There are some notable exceptions to this general rule. The exceptions are given by the king, by God. She may participate in congregational singing. I believe confess faith in Christ prior to baptism. She confess sins before the assembly. At least she can do those things. The other position, women may not take leadership roles. Please understand that the non-traditional brethren would not be. They would not argue, they would not agree with what Jay Gwynn says, what Bobby Valentine says. Under certain circumstances, they do allow women to But I have heard testimony from Christians who have seen it, where women assault during the assembly of the Lord's church, and particularly during the eating of the Lord's Supper. It's not my intention to say, and I am not implying, that this sort of activity takes place in every worship gathering among our non-traditional brethren. And I'm not saying that it takes place on every feast day of the week in the churches where it does occur, but I have had personal dealings with brethren of this mindset in the location where I am. I have almost no dealings with people in these non-traditional groups and other places. And again, we can talk about that in a little more detail in the question and answer session, but I know of brethren, and it's been discussed already a little bit, to allow women to speak when the local church is assembled. And I would suggest that that is in clear violation of Paul's teaching, 1 Corinthians chapter 14. At the end of the outline, I've listed some things, so many things that godly women can do. And as a matter of fact, where would we be, not just without our wives? One of the most touching stories in the whole Bible to me is the story that is told in Ezekiel chapter 24. You remember what happens? That God comes to Ezekiel and says to Ezekiel, Nebuchadnezzar started the siege of Jerusalem. And here's how we're going to teach that lesson to the Jews in captivity. When you get up in the morning, your wife will be born. I'm taking away from you the apple of your heart, the desire of your heart. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to get up. She's dead. I want you to get up, and I want you to get dressed, and I want you to go out among the people and just act like that. You can't mourn. You can't cry. And they're going to ask you, what is going on? Why are you doing this? And you're going to tell them, God is about to take away the apple of your eye, the city of Jerusalem. But what amazes me about that story is I cannot conceive of how I might have accomplished any good for God at all down through the years without the God of my wife Susan. And it's just, you guys feel the same way about your wives. I know that you do. That we're not challenging or questioning a woman's value. And God certainly doesn't. We're just insisting that all of us, men and women, in the work and the worship of the local church, abide by the roles, the rules, the instructions that are given to us by God. Thank you all very much for your time.